Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome. It's nice to have you all. Be'ez Hashem, we are going to begin our Chazara for the final exam of the summer 2021 Contemporary Halacha. We're going to be covering first the Halachas of Tumas Kohanim, Rabbi Konigsberg's Shir. So Be'ez Hashem, as follows. It's important to know that does a guy have give off Tuma? So the answer is yes, 100% Midoraisa for both Tumas Maga and Tumas Masa. However, the third type of tum, which is Tumas Ohel, there's Machlokes Tanoim, Machlokes Rishonim, Machlokes Shulchan Aruch, and Ramah. The Shulchan Aruch is a little more Machmir, and the Ramah is a little more Mekel. But even though the Ramah is a little more Mekel and assumes that Mi'ikra Din, there's no Tumas Ohel Baya and Akum, the Ramah says you should still be Machmir. Now, we're going to talk about a very important sex veka that the Dagul Mirvava puts forth that might be able to be an argument why a Kohen might be able to go to medical school, although we'll see that that's not going to work. So Dagum Ravava says as follows. I have a sex fake. There's a sheet of the Ravid who says that when it comes to a Nazir, Tumah B'chiburin means while you're, once you're already touching Tumah, you could touch more Tumah. So let's say that's not the Ravid yet. That's everybody agrees. If you're holding Tumah in your right hand, you could touch Tumah with your left hand. But what happens if you held Tumah today, and later this afternoon, in a way that you're not delaying your Tara process, are you allowed to touch Tuma again later that day? That's Machlokas. The Rama says it's Asr, but the Ravid says that it's Mutter because you're not being Mosif Tuma al Tumasa. Based on this Ravid, the Ravid says that since our Kohanim Bizman Hazer are all Tmei Mei, so we're not being Mosif Tuma al Tumasa. So every day they already have a din of being Tamei today, they could get Tamei more and more and more. There's nothing wrong with them becoming Tamei more and more and more and more. Okay, but that's Ravid is Meka, but we can't be Meka like a Ravid against the Rambam. However, there's another Tzad L'Hakel. When we talk about Tumas Ohel, and talk about going into a building without touching, let's say, but going to a building where there's a Tumei Meis, could a medical student do that? So if we have, says the Dagum Ravava, a Sek Sek, if we, on one hand, rely on the Ravid who says that every Kohen Bizman is already Tamei, and you're not being Mosif Tumal Tumaso, so you have the Heter of Tumal B'chibur. And you hold, but we don't pass like that. It's okay. There's also, you can mitzari sorry if the Shita Drama, there's no Tumas all by Akum. You have a Svek, Sveka, to be Matir, the situation of a Mace Akum for Ohel, and thereby allowing a Jewish medical student to attend medical school. That's what the Dagum Revava should come out with. However, we cannot rely on this Dagum Ravava. Moshe says you can't rely on this Dagum Ravava for a number of reasons. First of all, the Ravid that he's relying on as one of the two Sveikas is A, Adasi. It's not just one of two Shitas, it's Adasi Achid. B, the Ravid might have been Choser in one of his other Svarim. C, the Ravid, when he says that there's no Isser for Kohanim to become Tami because they're Tami anyway, that might just have meant that they don't get Malkos if they become Tami, but it might still be Asim Daraisi, even according to the Ravid, the Makel sheet of the Ravid. And therefore, Ramosha says that a Kohen is not permitted to attend medical school in such a way that he would become Tamei Lameis. And you can't use the argument that it's Pikuach Nefesh either, because you're only obligated to save a life that you encountered. You're not obligated to go to school to learn how to save lives. And Ramosha has some other svaras to argue that there's no Heter Pikuach Nefesh. Just like you don't have to become a millionaire in order to give tzedakah, you don't have to go to medical school to fulfill the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh. So Ramosh says there would not be a heter for medical students, Jewish medical students, to go to medical school or dental school in a case that they would become tamei meis. Next point. What about a kohen visiting a family member in the hospital? So we have the issue of course, of tumas meis. And the Ramah Mi'ikra Din is Mekel, if it's only Tumas Ohel. And we know that a Goseis is Asr, even to, it's Asr for a Kohen to visit a Goseis, even before he's going to die, because the Shulchan Aruch says Asr for a Kohen to come into a Goseis, and the Ramah says Mutter was still Tov L'Hachmir. Now, even if the patient is not a Goseis, but there might be a mace in the building, and the problem would be if you visit a Kohen visits and there will be an open door, the roof will be mitzaref, all the ma'ahir, all the will be mamshech, the tuma from wherever that mace is, out the door into wherever other rooms that have open doorways. So, okay, but if you close the door of the dead body would perhaps, hopefully, would be closed, and the room that you'll visit will be closed I don't know if you can ensure that, but let's say you can. There is still yet another problem. That's the problem of Sof Tuma Latze. Sof Tuma Latze tells us that even if all the doors are closed, which theoretically should be Chotis Bifnei HaTumah, prevented from spreading, nevertheless, wherever the mace will ultimately be passing through later on their way out to be buried or wherever else they're being taken, the Tuma that will later be there is considered there to be there right now. Now, there's machlokes if that's a din, that we consider the Tuma in the room, that in the hallway, for example, that the mace will later be taken out of, machlokes if that's considered Tuma Midaraisa now or Tuma Midrabana now. That's a machlokes. And there's also a tzad lahaka when it comes to Sof Tuma Latzeis that we could suggest when it comes to a mace of an akum, that maybe we could argue that the only reason why there's this Isser Sof Tuma Latzeis is because it's vadai. Let me rephrase that. It should only, maybe we could argue that it's only usher by a mace of a yid. But in Chutz La'aretz, where the rov misim, mesim are goyim, maybe you could be make a why. Because what's the whole svara of Sof Tuma Latzeis? Some of those is that the guy is going, the mace is going to be brought into the hallway. But you only have to bring a mace into the hallway by a Jew because it's a chiv kvura. But by an akum where there's no chiv and kvura, maybe it doesn't have to be that the mace will ever be brought out. They could leave the mace in the hospital room forevermore. There's no chiv to be mechayiv him, the mace to be brought out. So maybe there shouldn't be a din of Sof Tuma Latzeis by an akum. One could argue that, but most poskim assume that there is a promise of Tuma Latzeis when it comes even to Meise Akum. Okay, that's one issue in terms of Tosef Tuma Latzeis. Another issue is to be aware of the skeleton. You know, even if there's no mace right now, there could also be skeletons in the closets, literally, in the medical professor's closets. They could have skeletons there that would also be Metame et Kohen. Meikar Hadin, Ramosha does allow a close relative when there's a serious reason, at Tzorach Gadol Ma'od, Ramosha does allow a Kohen to go to a hospital to Mimbar Gacholim, based on the fact that Meikar Hadin, we would be Mekel by Tumas Ohel of an Akum. Next point. What happens if you have a pregnant Eshes Kohen? So we know that a Kohen has to make sure that even his son, his child, is careful about not becoming tummy. But does that mean that if his wife is pregnant, Mrs. Kohen is pregnant, that she can't go to a Levaya or can't go to a cemetery? So the Shach quotes Rokeach, who suggests the following Svek Sveka. Safek, that the baby that she's carrying will be a Nefel and will not live. Safi ben Kayama, and Safek Zachar, who's bound by the halachas of Tumas Kohen, Safek Nekeva, a woman is not bound, a female Koheness is not bound by the halachas of Tumas Kohen. That's the sex veka of the Rokeach. Now, Magen Avraham asks a very simple question on this Rokeach. Wait a second, why do you have to come up to a heta because of sex veka? What do you mean? It's Tahara Blua. And we know that Tuma Blua is not Metame. So you can't, if the baby is ensconced in his mother's womb, he can't become Tame from that which is outside of him, in the cemetery, the grave. So there's a very important Reb Chaim Ozer, Achiezer, and he's Mechadish Yisod that we're going to see in a few places, that perhaps the Isser of Tumas Kohanim is not that the Kohen can't become Tameh, but the Kohen has an Isser to be Miskariv Lemes. So even if technically you're right, as the Magen Avraham asked, it's Tara Blua, Tuma Blua, and the fetus will not actually become Tameh, but nevertheless, if the fetus would be next to a, you know, in an Ohel HaMes, at a funeral, it'd still be Miskariv to the Mes. And therefore, that's the Isra of a Kohen to be miskayv to mace, even though there's actually not a practical, a real tuma that will be contracted. That's a Reb Chaim Oz's answer to the Magen Avraham's kasha. Now, let's just point out that this heter that the Rokeach puts forth to be matir a Kohen to go to a funeral is assuming a double suffix. Safik Nefel, Safik Ben Kayama, and Safik Zachar, Safik Nekeva. But once you're in the ninth month, there's no Safik Nefel anymore. And now that we have ultrasound, we could determine the gender, whether it's a zachar or a nekeva. The ultrasound has been mevarif for us, the suffix of suffix nekeva, suffix zachar. So theoretically, if a woman has a hakamas metzeva coming up that she could schedule, you know, again, levayis, you don't have time to get sonograms. But if there's a hakamas metzeva, you could find out if it's a boy or a girl. If it's a boy, then she doesn't have a sex fake because she can't attend. That is the halacha regarding a woman, pregnant woman, going to a levaya or a cemetery. Now, there's another application that Rav Shechter used to apply this concept of Rav Chaim Ozer, of not actually that the Isser of Tumas Kohen is not just to become Tamei, but to be close to a Kohen, to a mace. There's a halacha called Cherev Harehu Kecholo, which means that any metal that touched a dead body will also be Tamei forevermore. So Tosfos asks, Rav Chaim Kohen and Tosfos says, every metal, every house has some metal that was in contact with Tmei Meis. Why? And yet we in this Shaila of Chaim Harei Kecholo, the Ramah is Mekel. How could there be Shitas that are Mekel? After all, shouldn't there be Tumah there? So Rav Shechter suggested that even though Chaim Harei Kecholo might carry Tumah, but the Isser of Tumas Kohen is not to become Tumah, it's to be in a Sky of Lameis. And if you're in contact with a scalpel that 5 years ago touched a mace, or was in contact with a mace, or was in a building with a mace, that might make you tummy, but that's not the issue of Tumas Kohen. Tumas Kohen is to become karav to a mace. And since this scalpel hasn't been in your dead body in 5 years, by you coming in contact, you the Kohen coming in contact with this scalpel, that's not being this karav to a mace, and that's therefore not a violation of the issue of kahuna. Okay, let's talk about a different point in kahuna. And that's the question of, can you drive on a road that goes over a cemetery? So first you have to figure out if a car is chotzeitz bifnei hatumah. So we could argue that a car is, meaning the bottom of the chassis, the bottom of the car, will separate between the tumah below and you who's sitting in the car. So the car says that, so the one reason to say that you can't be in such cars, because the car is an ohel zarek. An ohel zarek, although if you'd be in an ohel would be protect you and ensconce you and protect you from tumah that's around you. But if it's an ohel zarek, lo shmei ohel. And since the car is moving, it has din an ohel zarek, therefore maybe lo shmei ohel. Secondly, even if you hold ohel zarek is shmei ohel, but the chassis is metal, and something that's itself mekabel tumah cannot be chotzeitz bifnei hatumah. So therefore a car will not be a savior. You have to realize that when there are trees around the trees, if there's a mace under a branch and the branch is thick enough or the foliage is thick enough, it carries the tumah on the length of that branch, and a kohen would be standing underneath that, that the extension of that branch would also be in trouble. Let's talk about an airplane over a cemetery. An airplane over a cemetery is not, it is a problem that the airplane might fly over a kever, which is ma'ahil. And that's Aser D'Oraisa. Certainly it could be Kever Yisrael. That would definitely be Aser D'Oraisa. What about the plane? Could the plane be Chotzis Mefnei HaTumah? So maybe we could argue that the plane is not metal. What does that mean? We know that the Torah lists six metals, and aluminum, which planes are made out of, is not one of them. So that's Machlokes Achron. The Gra says only these six metals that the Torah lists specifies are metal, are Mekabel Tumah, and therefore an aluminum plane would not be Mekabel Tumah and would be Chotzis Mefnei HaTumah. But other Achron, the Tiferes Yisrael, says no, any element, any what you and I call metal that has those metallic properties also have a din metal. But even if you're make a, like the Gra, that aluminum is not considered metal, it still might be problematic because the steel or the iron nuts and bolts and screws are mamid the aluminum. They hold it together, and that would be mamid ohel v'dabraham akabotom. That might still be problematic. Rav Shechter argued that even if we say that the plane cannot be chotzeitz and the tumah would be coming straight through the plane, but maybe we could use that svarah we mentioned of the Achiezer previously, that when it comes to tumas kohen, this is not to become tameh. He is becoming tameh on top of a mace, but it's to become in close contact with the tumah, with the mace. And if you're flying 5,000 feet above sea level, 5,000 feet above, 20,000 feet above a grave, that's not becoming close. And maybe that would not be aser based on that same Achiezer that we mentioned previously. finally to finish this year. What about if there's a dead a mace in the cargo? So theoretically, the goal would be to put the mace into a plastic box so that the box will be chotzeitz and there won't be any tumma that will travel to the passenger section. The problem is that we could argue maybe the box is an ohel zara because the box is flying in the air. I mean, it's not flying on its own. It's in the belly of the plane, which is flying. So maybe an ohel zara can't be chotzeitz b'fnei tumma. So here we have to question, is a box that's in a belly of an airplane in a cargo hold, is that called flying? Because relative to the passengers, it's not flying. But relative to the ground, it is flying. So that will determine whether it's ohel zara or not. Another question that we have to question whether the box will be a good chatzitza to contain the tumah and allow kohen to be in the passenger section is that maybe the plane is held, the box isn't standing in midair, it's being held up by a plane, and the plane is itself mekabel tumah, as we mentioned before, and so it might be mamid b'davar mekabel tumah because it's holding the box in the air. So therefore, there's a question if a kohen can ride on a plane that that has a mace on it. Any questions so far? We finished this year. We're now going to go. If you have any questions, you're welcome to interrupt me or you can wait till I finish a section and then interrupt me at that point. That would be ideal. I'll try to be very clear and delineate when I'm starting a new section within each of the different shiurim. Okay, let's now talk about brain death.
Rav Orlian, sorry to interrupt. Did you discuss the issue regarding the tree hanging out from the cemetery, or did I miss that?
I mentioned it just in one line. That if there's a tree that's sticking out and you're walking under the, and there's a branch that's extending and that branch is covering a mace, you shouldn't walk under the extension of that branch because that would be considered tumas hamshacha. The branch is being mamshacha. One second. Okay. Brain death. So we have to, of course, there was a very long hakdama to this year to demonstrate that brain death, what you hold regarding brain death, is not a question of the science, because it's not a scientific question. It's a question of science tells us when different things are happening to the body, but who's to say what the definition of life is? That's a value judgment, not a medical judgment. So we do need medicine to tell us what's happening in the body. But whether whatever is happening in the body, is that's called life or that isn't called life, that's a value question. And therefore, that's a question for the Gedolei HaPoskim, not for you, not for me, not for a bunch of people with the name Rabbi in front of their name who could be plastered on an advertisement by an organization, but rather by the Gedolei HaPoskim, the greatest Poskim of our generation. That's the first point. Second point, we have to realize that although theoretically there's an iser of nivel hameis that we're very careful about, and we are very much against autopsies in general, but when it comes to saving a life, then we will discard the concern of nivel hameis in order to do pikuach nefesh. However, when it comes to certain organs, you could only do the pikuach nefesh if you kill, or if you, that's what we have to figure out, if it's killing or not killing. If you take the organ that you need, if you harvest the organ from a brain dead patient. Now, a patient with brain death, if he's alive, then you're taking out his heart, his lungs, you're killing him in order to save somebody else's life. You're not allowed to do that because that's Ritzich is one of the Gimel Yehar Vayavers. You cannot let to save a life by killing a life. You're not allowed to kill a life in order to save a life. That's Yehar Vayavar. On the other hand, if a brain dead person is indeed dead, so he's dead and you could save a life with that body, that would be fabulous. That would be Pikoch Nefesh, which would be Docher and Nivel Hameis. So here we have to realize that the shaila of brain death only arose once there existed a technology, the concept of a respirator, a ventilator. And the reason for that is because until we had respirators, and I guess in the 60s, once a person stopped breathing, their heart would stop pumping shortly thereafter. What we could do now is we could allow, even if a person can't breathe, we could breathe for them. We attach them to a respirator and the air gets oxygen or air gets pumped into their lungs and we continue to oxygenate their sub-pumping, you know, even though their own body, their own brain has isn't that part of the brain is not working and that part of the body is not working, but we could continue to pump artificially air or oxygen into their lungs and make them continue to breathe. And as long as they are breathing, the heart will continue to pump. Now, it's true that the head controls the breathing. And therefore, if the head is not going to work, then it can't breathe on its own. You have to use a mechanical device to make it breathe. However, the heart is not like that. As long as the breathing is continuing, even though there's no signal from the brain, the heart can still pump. The heart has something called automaticity, that it will beat even without a signal from the brain. So as long as there is a machine that's breathing it, that's breathing for this body, again, I don't know if it has life or not life, that we'll have to discuss as we go. But if there's air coming into the lungs through this machine, then the heart can continue to beat, even though there's no message from the brain, because the brain is what we call dead. And there's no one's questioning that the brain is dead. The question is that death of the brain or that cessation of the signals from the brain make it that the patient is considered dead. So Harvard had a commission about, 40 years ago, a little more now, and said that if a person is brain dead, we could consider them to be dead. But that was Harvard's definition of death. I don't know if that's necessarily our definition of death. So the sugya goes, starts with the Gemara and Yuma. Peches Amar Aleph, Mefachin Hagal B'Shabbos, and you have to check Pehei Amar Aleph, Atechen Hu Bodek. Where do you have to check when you arrive at right after Surfside? We understand what this means to go on Shabbos, to go through the rubble and violate Yisurim Daraisa, as we know the Israeli team was just last week. The Mechal Shabbos, without a question, to see if they could save any survivors from a Mapolas. So you have to check if the person, you come across a body, could you continue to be Mechal Shabbos? So if he's alive, yes. If he's not alive, no. So check if he's alive. So the Gemara says, there's a machlokas. Do you check until his nose or do you check until his heart? So if you stop here, it sounds like there's a question in the Gemara, there's a machlokas, whether a person is alive based on his breathing, ad chotmo, or ad lib, if he's alive because his heart is beating or not. That's what it sounds like. It happens to be all the Rishon and Paskin, ad chotmo. Sounds like, if we stop here, that breathing is the determining factor of life. If we stop here, so that would mean that a person who's brain dead and can't breathe on his own is dead. However, the Gemara continues and says that this machlokas is only a discussion of, it depends on whether you found the person, again, we said adhechnu bodik, are you coming from the head to the toes or are you coming from the toes to the head? The Gemara says that if you're checking him from the, the way Rashi says it, in a way that you're checking from the head to the toes, you arrive at the head and you check the nose and the nose doesn't have any breathing, says Rashi, you could be sure that his heart has stopped. So in other words, the checking from the nose is not really checking for breathing. It's the way to ascertain that the heart has stopped. So according to this, the two opinions, according to Rashi, the two opinions in this Gemara is not a machlokas of what is the criteria, what determines death. Everyone agrees that it's the heartbeat that determines death. The machlokas of whether you bodek him ad chotmo or ad libo, until you're checking his breathing or you're checking his heart, is that these are two different ways to determine, is there a heartbeat? Is it enough to check the heart alone? Or do you have to check if there's a heartbeat by seeing if he's breathing? If he's breathing, there must also be a heartbeat. According to this, according to the way Rashi learns the Gemara, and we don't have any other Rishonim who say otherwise, it seems to be that the machlokas in our Gemara, both opinions hold that it's the heart that is beating that determines life. We just have to figure out how to evaluate, is the heart beating or is the heart not beating? If that's the case, then the way I just presented, the way Rashi seems to be learning, a body that has its heartbeat that's beating is alive. Even though they might not be breathing, as long as the heart is beating, which could happen even after the brain is dead and is no longer sending a signal to breathe and you need machines to help it breathe, but as long as the heart is beating, the body is alive. In other words, according to the way I just said, according to Rashi and this Gemara, Rashi's exposure to this Gemara, a brain dead person whose heart is beating is still alive. And if that's the case, brain death is not death, and one cannot use the organs of a brain dead body. this discussion came to a fore when the Chasam Sofer was asked or was discussing a shaila in that time when they buried bodies and the government said you shouldn't bury any bodies for 3 days because maybe they're not really dead and you want to make sure they're dead before you bury them. So the Chasam Sofer said, if the body is not moving and there's no heartbeat, there's no breathing, you can assume he's dead and bury him right away. So it sounds like if any of these, you have to have all three things. If any of these things are not, if you don't, can't check off, you know, if you have a body that's not breathing and there's no heartbeat, but he's jumping up and down and talking to you, obviously he's not dead. If you have a person who's not moving, but he's breathing, so you know he's alive. So similarly, according to the Chasam Sofer, it sounds like you need all three criteria in order to qualify as dead. You need to have not movement and no heartbeat and no breathing, and then you're dead. But if your heart is moving, then that's called brain dead, but the heart is still moving. Remember, brain death just means that the brain functions are stopped and therefore there's no breathing, but the heart could still pump. And it sounds like that would not be sufficient to constitute death. There would have to be, as long as the heart is beating, there might still be life. So that's what it seems to be. Rov Poskim seem to assume that brain death is not death, and it would be to take an organ from a brain dead person would be murdering this person. The Rabbanut suggests, has a Dik Ramam, that they argue otherwise. There's another source that's important. That's one source that we did, this Gemara of Ad Heichon Bodek, and then there's one other source that we're going to focus on, Mishnah Olos. Mishnah Olos talks about when is a person metame, when they die. So the Mishnah says that a goses is not metame, a person whose limbs are chopped off is not metame, only when you're dead. Or, says the Mishnah in Olos Alephov, when the head is chopped off, even though the body is jumping up and down, that's just, you know, neuroelectrical impulses, that is also considered death. So that means, and therefore there's tuma. So we have two criteria for tuma: either death, obviously, or even if you don't necessarily have death, if the body if the head is severed. So what does it mean that the head is severed? So there are a number of ways to understand this vision, that the head is severed, that makes you tuma. The Rabbanut says that, all we really care about is there's no breathing. Brain death is death. And as long as the brain is dead and he's not breathing, there's no breathing. So if you chop off his head, he's not breathing anymore, so he must be dead. The problem with that is you could have somebody who's unable to breathe on his own, right? Christopher Reeve, Superman, after he got his injury when he fell off the horse, couldn't breathe on his own. He had a machine that breathed for him. According to the Rabbanut, he's dead. But he was still married. He was going around giving lectures. He was speaking. He was talking. And we're saying that he's dead and he's metame ba'ohel because he can't breathe. That doesn't seem logical. Roy Tendler had a suggestion that if the brain isn't doing its job, right, the brain is supposed to integrate the whole body. It's supposed to be it's supposed to bring all the things in the body together. And if the brain is not doing that, so even if the brain happens to be physically attached, that's what the Mishnah is telling you. The brain is severed, then you're dead. So Tendler wants to suggest that if the brain is not doing its function, the person is dead. But that happens to be that there are recent reports that indicate that even after brain death, the body is still works as a whole. What's called somatic integration, not for now, that even after brain death, the body is still working as a unified whole. Rubleich and Roshachta say a very nice understanding of what brain death, of why this Mishnah shows you that brain death is not death. They say, the Mishnah is teaching us a chiddush. The Mishnah is telling you that you chop off the head, and even if the body is jumping up and down, that's still considered dead. What is it saying? It's saying that whenever there's motion, that tells you that there's life. This Mishnah tells you that there's one type of motion that is not life. After the brain is chopped off and the body is jumping up and down, that is the one motion that is not life. But any other motion would be life. So for example, if you have a beat heart that's beating, that is, means the body is moving. So that this Mishnah that says the only motion that's not life is after you chop off the head, the pirchus, the jumping up and down of a severed head, that is not considered life, but any other motion is considered life. So heartbeat would indicate life. And therefore, brain death would not be brain death. That's how Rabbi Bleich, Rabbi Schechter explained this Mishnah accordance with their opinion that brain death is not death. Okay, that's as far as the shiur on brain death. Any questions on brain death?
Rabbi?
Yes.
The Gemara in Yuma, Pehei, Ta'adehechon Ubodeh Achot, Nishom Al-Diba. So what was the answer that even according to Manda Omer, that it's at Chotmo, nevertheless, we could say that he still holds it a hard
time. One second. Even if you say ad chotmo, the Gemara says that if you're checking, if you're coming to approaching the rubble and you reach this body, this motionless body in the rubble, you're coming from the head. When the Gemara said bodik ad chotmo, it means once you get to the chotmo, you don't have to check anymore. But really, because you don't have to check if the heart is beating anymore. But both opinions are assuming that the heartbeat is what is determining whether he's alive or not. The Rashi says it. When the Mandom is said Chotma, it doesn't mean, Rashi says, that the breathing is what determines whether he's alive or not. The one who says Ad Chotma, says Rashi, sometimes you can't tell whether his heart is beating by looking at his chest, so you could tell whether his heart is beating by seeing if he's breathing. If he's breathing, that must mean that the heart is still beating. And therefore,
it's still to figure out about the heart.
Exactly. That's the point. That both opinions are assuming that the life is determined by the heart beating. The question is, is it enough to check the heart? Or sometimes it's a very low heart rate, low pulse, whatever it is. You can't really tell the heart. So you go to look at the nose to see if you know that there's breathing, then you know the heart must definitely still be working. So then you know that the heart is beating and he's still alive. But the crux is whether the heart is beating. Okay.
Thank you.
Now I'm going to go to the next shiur. Next shiur is electricity by Rabbi Packer. So it's important to realize when you deal with electricity, the shiur that we're handling is not what is the electricity doing. I mean, when you talk about a light bulb, that might be Havara because the incandescent filament is glowing. When you talk about a microwave, you're doing Bishel. When you talk about a tractor, you're doing Kotze. When you talk about a laundry machine, you're doing Koves. We're not talking about the malachas that you're accomplishing with electricity. We're talking about creating the electrical circuit itself. What malacha, if any, is that violent? Like turning on a fan. Turning a fan, you're not doing anything, you're not heating anything up, you're not cooking anything, you're not harvesting anything, you're not cleansing anything. You're just turning on a fan and it's turning. So there's no malach involved. The question is, what is electricity malach? That's our question to discuss today. Now, as we discuss the various shitas, it could be that none of them are right. It could be that everyone is right. It could be that when you turn on an electrical current, maybe you're going to be violating everything we're going to talk about today. So there's no consensus that it's this or this is. We just have to be aware of the different possibilities of what it could be. So the original Aruch HaShulchan's suggestion in the early 1900s was that electricity is fire. There's fire in the wires, and therefore, if it's a havara, it should be mutar on yontif. But you and I know that that's no longer understood. There's no fire in the wires, and there's no havara. No one says b'zman hazeh that electricity is havara. We're past that. Okay. So now we're going to talk about the opinion of the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish says electricity would be an issur midoraisa. Let's try to understand why. He says two possible reasons. Number one, because of Tikkun Mana, which we'll talk about in a moment. Tikkun Mana, which is Makkah B'Patish, an issur midoraisa of Makkah B'Patish, or because of Binyan, as we'll explain also, the Malacha D'Oraisa of Binyan. So let us understand, what does he mean by Makkah B'Patish? What does he mean by Bonah? So says the Chazon Ish, and I'll put Rabbi Packer's explanation of the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish doesn't explain himself as thoroughly as Rabbi Packer explained it, that tikkun mana is that you're making something work. So it's not that, the simple way is like, oh, you created a circuit. No, Rabbi Packer explained, it's not that you create a circuit, that's the tikkun mana. It's that you took this lifeless, motionless chunk of metal and plastic, and by allowing the electricity to run through, by creating the circuit, you gave not life to the circuit, but you gave life to this hunk of metal and plastic to make it a usable item, to make this hunk of metal and plastic no longer a hunk of metal and plastic. It's now called a fan. It's now called an air conditioner. is now called a refrigerator. That is the tikkun mana, that you're creating this item, giving this item chiyus. It's not that you're putting chiyus into the electricity, it's that by putting chiyus into this appliance, you're making the electricity have meaning, and creating that meaning in this appliance is the tikkun mana. Now, we know that there's ain binyan bekelim, but there is sometimes binyan bekelim when you do something called teka, taf kuf ayin, which is something that's very firm, a very firm connection. So Rashi holds, I'm sorry, there's never been a bekelim, but teka would still be, according to Tosis, if you've created firmly, there would be binyan bekelim. So according to Tosfos, there might be a problem of makor patish. So Shlomo Zalman says it's not so hard, so strongly connected. You just flick it on and off, on and off, on and off. That's not such a strong connection like teka. Well, Rabbi Packer explained, no, what the Chazanish might be meaning is that it's not firmly connected, physically firmly connected. It's not like you screwed in something really tight. That's not what the Chazanish meant by firmly connected. What we mean is that it was a meaningful connection. That might be why it's teka. Yes, you could just flip it on. But when you flipped it on, there's something very gigantic that has been created. That would be attempted to be the isra of that the Chazanish is intending of Makav Patish. Second, says the Chazanish, when you plug in the appliance into the wall, so that might be Binyan B'Mechuber, because you're building the circuit while it's making it attached to the house, because you're plugging into the wall, that would be Binyan B'Mechuber, which is, so again, so we have Binyan B'Kalim, which is a violation of Tekah. That's sort of one iser. Then we have makav patish. And thirdly, if it's a wire to the house, the Chazanish would argue that that would be another iser daraisa of binyan b'mechuber. Obviously, if you have a battery-operated circuit, that would not be binyan b'mechuber, but it might still be binyan b'kelim, because you're making the item, this appliance, come a maves l'chayim. That's the opinion of the Chazanish. Oh, I'm sorry, that's the opinion, right, that's binyan b'chazanish. That's also daraisa. However, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman rejects the Chazanish piece by piece, and he says this is not called binyan b'mechuber, because you know what it's more similar to? Binyan b'mechuber is when you take something, you attach it to a house. When you have a door that's attached to a house, you open the door and close the door. No one says that when you close the door, it's bona, and when you open the door, it's soser, one of the other 39 malachas. No one says it. Why? Because it's darko b'kach. So just like opening and closing a door is not bona, so too, taking the switch, flipping a switch on and off, that would not be bona b'mechuber. And nor is it, says Chazan, no, says Shlomo Zalman, it's not tekaf. Tekaf is a firm connection, like stick the glasses lens into a rim of a you stick the glasses lens into the rim of a glasses. That would be firm connection that might constitute tekaf. But here we have something that you could flick on and off, like on and off. That would not be considered teka. And therefore, Shlomo Zalman says that there's definitely no issa d'oraisa that would be violated when there is a use of electricity. It happens to be most of the YU poskim are maker like Rav Shlomo Zalman to assume that electricity is not d'oraisa, but there are poskim who do assume, like the Chazanish, that electricity could be d'oraisa. Now, there's a very important Yerushalmi that Rav Asher Weiss found that maybe is also pshat in the mind of the Chazanish. Maybe Moshe Feinstein might also hold this. He's not clear. It might mean this. The Yerushalmi that Rav Asher Weiss quotes in his tshuva, where Rav Asher Weiss concludes that electricity isn't his d'oraisa, is the following. That normally you and I assume that we are 39 malachos, 39 avos, and we look at each of the avos and we see what's similar to it. This is there's an av, and this must be a told of the av. This is a different av, so it has these toldos. But the Yerushalmi says the opposite. The Yerushalmi says that they found many toldos of malachos, but whenever they found out that a tolda that would be aser, and they couldn't figure out what av to attach it to, they just called it makav patish. When everyone knows it's aser, but you don't know where to put it, they put a makav patish. So Asher Weiss says electricity. Everyone knows that electricity is aser. No question about that. What it mean? We just don't know where to put it. We don't know how to put it on this, on this, on this, and this. So when you don't know where to put an iser, where do you put it? You put it into makom patish. If that's what the Chazanish said, that's a very strong point. That maybe the makom patish, even if it doesn't fit all the criteria of the typical makom patish that we are familiar with, bona that we're familiar with, but if we know that it's that this must be included, this power of electricity, of an electrical circuit, is something that is definitely going to be us, so we don't know where to put it. So that's what the Chaznish maybe meant by Makka v'Patish. That's a fascinating Chiddush of Yerushalmi, and that might be a new way of understanding why electricity could be an Issa D'Oraisa of Makka v'Patish. Ramosha doesn't have a clear indication in his tshuvas of the nature of electricity, unfortunately. He has two tshuvas, one after the other. The first is talking about a microphone, and he says that a microphone has a chash midoraisa in use of a microphone, but the next tshuva is talking about a hearing aid, and he said a hearing aid is mutter. So it's hard to understand. They both use electricity. A microphone is a bigger demonstration that electricity is a bigger, you know, makes noise, is more visible. So without going through each of those tshuvas, which each say, you know, different points, but it's hard to figure out what Moshe held. It's important to know that there are two other shitas of what electricity might be, besides the Chaznish, besides Rav Shlomo Zalman, besides this idea of that we saw from Vashra Weiss about what Makka v'Patish might mean in this case. That's three ideas. There's a fourth one of the Beis Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Shmelkes, that it might be similar, akin to being molid reach, just like you're not allowed to be molid reach into begadim, so too you're being molid something amorphous into these, like a reach, or in this case, electricity, into the wires, or into the appliance. That might be a case of molid. That's an interesting svara. Rabbi Schechter suggests that maybe it's similar to the sugya of tsinor sha'alu bal kas kasin. If you have a stuffed up gutter, a stuffed up leader, that the water comes down and stuffed up with branches and with leaves, so you're not allowed to unplug that on Shabbos under normal circumstances. So maybe that's similar to what's happening in an electrical current. You're right now, there's resistance, there's a stopping, and you're allowing the electrons to flow. That would be like tzina shalu ba kas kasin, and you're unplugging it. That would similarly be problematic, like that. So good. So those are the five different ideas of what might be the issur of electricity. Maybe it's one of them, maybe it's none of them, maybe it's all five of them. Now, another subcategory of this discussion is the concept of semiconductor. Semiconductor is like your screen on your phone. Right now it's blank, but when you touch it, you're not creating a new circuit. The circuit's already there, but you're just changing the resistance and allowing the current to flow, meaning you're making the current that's there already be poel, do something. Go mimavas l'chaim. So it depends on how we understand the Chazanish. If you understand the Chazanish when he said that it's just tikkun mana, you're creating a circuit. You're just making something, so you're not creating a circuit. But if we understand the Chazanish the way Rabbi Packer explained it, that you're making something meaningless into meaningful, not the point of the circuit Shabbos, it's the point of making the circuit is allowing this appliance to be meaningful. So then, even though there's a fully created circuit, when you touch the screen and allow the screen to do whatever you want it to do, that could be taka problematic, and might be, even though you're just using a semiconductor, that might be a problem of Makka v'Patish. Less significant is what we call shinui zerem, just changing the volume or brightness. That's when you already have the kli is on and there's a circuit. The circuit that's doing it is not so, doesn't do so much. When you change the volume, you're putting in a little more electricity, a little more, less resistance, more electricity coming through, make it a little louder. That would be not as bad. But again, if we say the way Rabbi Packer explained the Chaznish, that the point is that you're making something not useful to be useful, you might still have the problem of Shinui Zerem, still have the problem of Makka v'Patish, even by Shinui Zerem, which is a Chiddush. Okay, so that is the shiur on electricity. Any questions about the shiur on electricity?
Can everybody just explain what Shinui Zerem is? I missed that. The change of the flow of things?
Yeah, change of current. I'm not an electrical engineer, but I believe it's like you have a little bit of electricity running through or a lot of electricity running through. So when you change the volume or you change the level, the magnitude of something that's on a dial, like it's at power 1 or power 8. So when you go from 1 to 3, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you're not creating a new circuit. The circuit's there. You're just allowing more and more and more and more and more and more and more, more, you know, more levels of electricity going through. And again, I don't know if that's really what happens. That's just how I understood what Rabbi Pack was describing. Packer understands these concepts better than I. I don't. He does. But I think that's how he was trying to describe the concept of a Shinri Zerem, as opposed to creating a new circuit, you have a pre-existing circuit that you're allowing more electricity to run through and therefore give off more power. Okay, let's now continue with the concepts of electricity and talk about our package here about the applications of electricity as far as security, hotel doors, automatic toilets and sinks applications. So the first, the most important, most common Shaila in this regard is standing in front of a camera. Most shuls nowadays in our communities have cameras. Many people have rings in front of their houses. So could you go to shul on Shabbos? Oh, I found a hetek. You don't have to go to shul anymore. You don't want to, you're going to be machmir on, you don't want to stand in front of the camera, so don't go to shul. The issue is as follows. Kosev, the Rambam tells us, Kosev is not just writing letters, as the Mishnah seems to indicate, it's also making pictures. So when I stand in front of a camera, what I'm really doing is I'm painting myself on the screen. So by me standing in front of a camera, I'm painting myself. I'm putting my body, a picture of my body right now. I'm standing in front of the camera. You're looking at me on Zoom. So I'm, by me being here, by me moving around, I'm painting myself onto each of your screens all around, wherever you guys might be. As close as far Rockaway, as I saw one of you this morning, or as far away as, I don't know where, you know, where all of you are. So there's a problem of Kosev. Now, even if let's say there would be no screen, but it's just being saved. So maybe there's another issue of the painting myself in a way that could be retrievable later. Separately, there might be another issue of, let's talk for now about being co-sav on the screen. Is that an issue? So maybe we could argue that being co-save myself onto a screen is not a problem. Why not? Because what's co-save? You have to define the word co-save. Co-save might mean taking a letter or taking a substance and applying it onto a medium, applying it onto a tablet. You take ink, you take graphite from a pencil, and you put it onto a piece of paper, onto a tablet, onto a medium. But if you would just have things go into the medium and the medium becomes part of the medium, that might not be co-safe. So here, where there's no background that has something plastered on top of it or written on top of it, it just becomes the letters of it or the picture on a screen is part of the screen itself, that might not be ksiva. Where do you see that? You see that very easily in the concept of a shadow or a mirror, where you're not applying something onto the screen, onto the mirror, you just... it's inside, you know, there's no application of any material onto the surface of a mirror, onto the surface of the shadow that you're causing. That's not co-save. So maybe we could argue that there's not going to be co-save in a screen. But maybe there's a different problem. Maybe there's the fact that you're putting yourself into a hard drive, that when I walk into my shul, it's recording me and it's going into a hard drive. Well, how, or the memory of the computer. Well, in order to access that memory, you have to type in a code. You have to do something to get out the information that was stored. So it could be the Gemara in the Yushalmi talks about a case when you send a letter in invisible ink and then the recipient pours some solution on top of the invisible ink and makes the letters appear. So is that considered a ksiva? So when you write in a way that requires a unique means to decipher that writing, that's not considered a kosher. So therefore, by you walking in a way and it's saved into the hard drive, again, it's not on any screen, it's just saved into the hard drive, since it has to be accessed through a specific computer program, that might not be considered that you're writing yourself, just like that Yushalmi. But regardless of kosher, there might be an issue of makke b'patish. Not makke b'patish because of the circuit, but let's say you have a recording, a file on a computer. Until now, the file was meaningless. But now that it has a picture of the people who came into shul on Shabbos, or the guy who stole or broke the window in shul on whenever he broke the window on at 3 o'clock in the morning, or Friday night, for example. So when you have the file that's being saved onto a memory stick, onto a CD, in the cloud, maybe it's a little more complicated. Maybe saving that image or that information might be making a permanent change, a permanent record. That might be making a cleat. What does it mean, making kli? Making kli, the way we explained in the Chazon Ish, that you're making something that was meaningful, meaningless. You have a blank file, a blank CD. We don't use CDs anymore. Blank memory key. We don't use memory keys anymore. And now there's information on it. It becomes a meaningful one. Like if I would, you know, you want to buy a CD again, nowadays everything's done online. A key. Now you get keys to things from the web. But let's say 10 years ago, if you wanted to buy a new CD from, I don't know, Yaakov Shweki, it's going to cost you $15 to buy the CD. If they would sell you a CD with nothing on it, it would be 50 cents. With the Yaakov Shweki's songs on it, becomes $15 because it became meaningful through saving the information on the CD. The CD didn't change physically, you know, maybe it did a tiny bit, but to the naked eye, it didn't change. But there was a change that was a change in the meaningfulness of the item. Maybe that would constitute Makkeh B'Patush. Okay, let's now move away from security cameras and talk about all the automatic items that you encounter when you go to a hotel. The automatic doors, automatic sinks, automatic toilets. So there's no malacha that's happening other than the electricity that's, you know, causes the door, that's mechanical, causes the flush, that's mechanical, causes the sink to flow, that's mechanical. There's no malacha that's happening. You're just doing a maisa to create the circuit and to let the electricity do its thing. So as we explained a few minutes ago, any of those five different suggestions of what is electricity is being violated, potentially. But it's important to know what the is of electricity is. We don't really know. But if we assume that it's going to be Darabon, there's a lot more room to be Mako. For example, let's say the Chazish told us that Bona, Makkeh B'Patush, is the Isser, Isser D'Oraisa. But maybe Makkeh B'Patush Abon is only when you make something that will last, that's permanent. Like you turn on a fan, the fan's going to continue to run for years. But if you have an electrical current that causes the electric door to unlatch, it's done. The unlatching was momentary. A sink that gave you water for 5 seconds, a toilet that flushed momentarily, a door that opened, and now after 5 seconds, now it's open. So those things that you accomplished, even if you did do a Makkeh B'Patush or a Bona, it was not a permanent, it didn't do something permanently, it just did something momentarily. Maybe that wouldn't be Doraisa anymore because it's not permanent. Another tzad that you could be makel if it's not Doraisa is, for example, like an alarm rings on Shabbos. So if it's Doraisa to do electricity, you can't tell the guy to do it. But if it's a Durabon, then you could ask if it's elf is only Durabon, and you're asking a Gentile to do it, and is it Tzarech Gadol, so it would be a Shvus to Shvus Makom Tzarech. Rabbi Packer pointed out that we know that Psik Resha is Aser. We know that we are Machmir on Psik Resha Dulanichale, that's also Aser. But it says Rabbi Packer, a tremendous chiddush. Not him, it's the Achronim suggests this. There is a shita, the Shemus Hadash is Mako by Psik Resha and the Rabbanim. There is a shita of the Aruch, the Tosis quotes, that Psik Resha Dulanichale is also Mutter. We don't hold like either of those. But says Rabbi Packer from the Achronim, that if you have a Psik Resha that's A, it's a Psik Resha, B, on an Issa Durabanan, and C, it's Lonichale, wow, Psik Resha Durabanan, that's Lonichale, maybe there, what's an example of Psik Resha Durabanan to Lonichale? Well, walking into Shul and getting your face printed on the screen is a Psik Resha. It's not your intent. It's Durabanan if we assume that this whole electricity thing and the writing thing is only Durabanan. And it's Lonichale because you couldn't really care less if your face was on the camera as you walked into Shul. So maybe Psik Resha Dulonichale on an Issa Drabanan could be Meka. Why? Because why are we Machmir on a Psik Resha Drabanan? I'm sorry, why does the Aruch say that Psik Resha Drabanan is more Lahakel? Because if it's an Issa Drabanan, so it's not a real Maisa. And why is the Aruch Mekel by Lo Nichalei that it's Mutter? Because Lo Nichalei means you don't care about it. So we're not Mekel on either of those accounts. But if you have both of those together, if you have the fact that it's a Drabanan and it's Lo Nichalei, so it's not considered to be a Maisa and you have no Kavana for it, so putting those two together, maybe that would make it Mutter. So if you have Psik Resha de Lo Nichalei on an Issa Drabanan, that Siruf might permit you to walk even through cameras and motion sensors that are detecting you. Okay. However, we have to keep in mind that the calling everything a psik resha is not always true, as follows. The easiest example is a refrigerator. When we assume that you opened up a refrigerator to get the orange juice and light clicks on, it happens all the time around in any community. There's always a family that left the refrigerator light and they left the light on Shabbos. So we'll say, oh, so psik resha. Now there are clues by psik resha. For example, there's no isra of amila nachri for psik resha. You tell a guy, please turn on the light in the fridge, that's aser. You tell a Gentile, please get me the oranges from the fridge. So you told them to get oranges. They got oranges. Something else happened when they did their maisa. It wasn't your maisa, it was their maisa. Were you mechavein? No. Did you tell them to do it? No. So the turning on the light that they caused indirectly, the psik resha, wasn't you. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman, wait a second. I don't think that should be called a psik resha. The light in the refrigerator, how do you turn on that light? Do you open up your fridge, then you flick on a switch to turn on the light? No. The way the light in the fridge is turned on is by opening the door and turned off by closing the door. So it's mituchnan lekach. It's designed that this is how you turn on the light. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman, that's not called a psik resha. So the same thing with the motion detector, Rav Shlomo Zalman would argue. The way the motion detector is not that you walked through and the light flicked on or something went on because of the motion, the alarm was set off. It's not that you walked in and just happened to set off the alarm. The way you set off this alarm is by breaking the beam or breaking the motion detector sensor mechanism. The way you flush a toilet, an electric toilet, is you stand up. You put your hands in front of the sink and it makes the water come out. So that's not called a psik resha. You know, that's actually more. That's not a psik resha. Those are, you really tried to do it. So let's say by a toilet. All you want to do is get up from the toilet. Psik resha, you broke the electricity, the sensor, now it's going to flush. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman, no, that's how you flush the toilet on an electric toilet. So Shlomo Zalman has this chumrah that a lot of these things that are designed to operate in this way, that this is how you turn the thing on or off, that's not called a psik resha. And therefore, you won't have a lot of the kulas, according to Shlomo Zalman. But you should just know that many Yechronim argue and say a lot of these things, like certainly turning the light on in the fridge, when you're just trying to open the door or close the door, and the light ends up turning on or off, that many people argue in Shlomo Zalman and assume that does have the kulas of a psik resha. Finally, the last point in this Shear is an important sad lahaka when you have security systems. Is a svara. Let's say you walk by and the light turns on. A sensor, you walk by and you're walking in a dark street and the light sensor turns on. So the Gemara in Shabbos talks about a deer that's caught in a room and you lock the door. The Shilte Giborim says the following. Even if you're mechavein to close the door and also to trap the deer, that's going to be mutter. Again, a deer walked into your house. You close it, you come in, you close the door behind you on Shabbos. You want to close the door behind you because you don't want the air conditioning to leave. You don't want the thieves to come in. But you also want to trap this deer. Shilte Giborim, even if that your chavana is also, it's for yourself to close the door to keep the air conditioning in and the thieves out. But it's also, you have a secondary kavanah to trap the deer. That's mutter, says Shilte Giborim. The Ran says, no, you can't have any kavanah to trap. But wait, this Rashba says that even though you did a maisa, a tzeda, but the result, meaning the fact that the animal is caught, is so far removed, the animal's over there, you walk closing the door there, the result is so far removed from what your action is. So even though we're not really making like this Rashba, but the poskim could be mitzari for that to permit certain situations that I'm walking over here and the sensor over there senses me and that's not what I intended to do. Even if I know that it's going to happen, there's more room to be makeup. Okay, that was the discussion of electricity. Any questions about electricity?
Yeah, who's the sheet who holds up psik resha on a derabanan and his mutter?
The Trumas Hadeshan, one of the Rishonim. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to the next shir. So Rabbi Willick's shir about family planning and contraception. We'll talk about Puravu. What's the gather of Puravu? Machlokas, basically, I'll explain it outside, and then we'll talk about three or four applications of this Machlokas. The Shaila is what is the mitzvah of Puravu? Is the mitzvah to have children? That's what the Menachas Chinuch posits. Or, as Rav Willig suggests, based on a Tosfos, is the Willig to do a Maisubiya. That's the mitzvah. And there's going to be a few nafkaminas, whether we assume it's the having the children that's the mitzvah, or whether it's the Bia that has the mitzvah. The first proof we could talk about is, let's say you have a Gentile who had children before before he was Megayer. So the Gemara tells us explicitly that when he comes to convert and he's a Jew, he doesn't have the mitzvah of Puruvu anymore. He fulfilled Puruvu. So the Mechitzah Kana says, you see that it's not the Maisa Bia, because he was a guy when he did the Maisa Bia. It's the having children. And now he's Jewish and he has children. So you see that having the children is the mitzvah. But Willick says, no. The Bia was the mitzvah. When we say, when the Gemara tells us that you fulfilled Puruvu and you're Megayer, that doesn't mean you get brownie points for Puruvu. It means that you no longer are Mechuyav in Puruvu. It doesn't mean you did a mitzvah of Puruvu. It means that this person, after he's Megayer, no longer has to check off the Puruvu box because he did it. He no longer has that obligation anymore. But not that the Bia was the mitzvah. Another place where you see this come out is the Gemara tells us explicitly, I'm sorry, the Ritva says, if you have a child, Be'isra, a Mamzer, you fulfilled Puruvu. What's the obvious question? What do you mean? It's Mitzvah Babavera. If the Bia is the mitzvah, it's a Bias Isser, so how could you fulfill Puruvu with a Bias Isser? So Michas Chinuch therefore has a great proof. The mitzvah is not the Bia. The mitzvah is having the children. When he has the children 9 months later, there was no Isser with a woman in the hospital giving birth. There was no Isser there. The Bia was just a Heksher mitzvah. We don't say mitzvah babaveiru by Heksher mitzvah. And the mitzvah is having the babies. That's why you fulfill Puruvu, even with a Mamzer, even with a child Be'isser. However, Rabbi Willig will say, no, the mitzvah is at the Shas Bia. You want to know why the Gemara said, why the Ritva says that you fulfill Puruvu, not because you fulfill the mitzvah. Of course, it's a mitzvah, but you didn't fulfill the mitzvah. But the mitzvah, you have two children, you have a boy and a girl, so it's no longer chiyuv for you to have anymore. Again, Rabbi Willig is saying there's no mitzvah, the Puruvu is, when these chazals or poskim say that you did the mitzvah of Puruvu, it doesn't mean you fulfill the mitzvah. It just means once you have a son and a daughter, there's no longer a mitzvah to do. You exempted whatever needs to be done because you already have the result. There is a boy and a girl here in the world. Another place where this machlokas comes through is the case of Nizra Aban Bati. A woman becomes impregnated by Zera that's floating around in a pool. And we paskin that Beis Shmuel says in Eben Ezer, the beginning of Eben Ezer, that's aviv hu l'chol davar, presumably even to fulfill Puruvu. What do you see? The Michas Chinuch says, you see there's no Bia, and still you fulfill Puruvu. So what's the mitzvah of Puruvu? Clearly not the Bia. It must be the having the children. That's all these cases are very mashma like the Michas Chinuch. These are great proofs of the Michas Chinuch. Rabbi Willig rejects this proof also by saying that, no, when it says Abba Pulu Chaldara, that you're Mekai Pruvu, not that you fulfilled Pruvu, but that you no longer have the Chiv of Pruvu because you already have children. Okay, that's the first piece. Then it's important to know next point now. The halacha of Pruvu, mitzvah Pruvu, is Mekuyam only if you have Zaro Miyuchas Acharam. So there has to be a connection between the babies that are born and the father. So for example, if a Gentile has children with a Yisraelis woman, those babies are her children, not his children. And even if he's going to be Megayer, they won't. He didn't fulfill Puruvu. He does have to have more children. If a Gentile married a Gentile woman and has children, they're Miyaches Miyuchaseach after him. And when he's Megayer, he doesn't have to fulfill the Mitzvah Puruvu anymore. However, if he's a Gentile and he has children with a Jewish woman, the children are Miyuchas after her, not him. And therefore, since those children are not miyuchas after him, he has the mitzvah now after conversion to be Mekayim, the mitzvah Puruvu. Similarly, let's say a guy has kids with a shifcha. Again, whose children are those? The Adon's, not his. After he's Megayer, he didn't fulfill Puruvu anymore. Let's say you have a Jew. Listen to this. If you have a Jew who had children with a non-Jewish woman, so he does not fulfill Puruvu. Why not? Because even though he's a Jewish and he has children while he's Jewish, but those children are Miyuchas Acharav, they're not Jews. They're Miyuchas Acharav, they're not Zara Miyuchas Acharav. accordingly, this is very nogeya. If you have IVF, in vitro fertilization, let's say you have a non-Jewish egg donor, and let's say you assume that the child follows the egg donor, the genetic mother, not the carrying mother, which is machlokas, and therefore the mother of this baby is really the donor, the non-Jewish donor, even though the husband's zera, the Jewish man's zera, the husband, Jewish husband's zera is used, and his wife is carrying this baby, but since the genetic material is provided by a non-Jewish woman, and therefore many poskim say that the non-Jewish woman is the mother, this man did not fulfill pruvu. So if you have a Jewish woman, according to this lambda, so if you have a Jewish woman whose eggs are not effective and has to use eggs from a donor, even though she's going to be, the Jewish wife will be carrying the baby of her husband with her husband's, using her husband's zera, that would not be pruvu. So wait a second. So if that's the case, you should not be able to have the, allow the husband to be motzi zera and impregnate his wife with his donor sperm, with his donor egg. And therefore, this woman who has low quality eggs or no eggs left is never going to be able to allow her husband to do pruvu because he's being shofar zelavatala because he's not fulfilling pruvu. I understand you're going to be motzi zera to fulfill pruvu. Sometimes they have to do it mechanically and they can't do it regularly through bia. But that's to have children to be fulfilled. Now you're telling me that if he has the donor eggs from the non-Jewish donor, he's not going to be in fulfillment of pruvu. So it should be asur. So Rabbi Willig suggests, and with an interesting cool, he says, even though there's not pruvu, there's still a fulfillment of shevis. And Rabbi Willig's mechadesh, that you could still, based on atosis, that you could still, the mitzvah shevis, which is also a mitzvah rabbah, is also sufficient to warrant a heter of shevich zera levatol. It's not considered levatol if it's to fulfill shevis. Even though he's not fulfillment of pruvu, but he would fulfill the mitzvah shevis, and that would be sufficient to allow him to be motzi zera, to impregnate his wife with a non-Jewish egg donor's egg. That's that point. That's the concept. Yes, go ahead.
Can you just go over what mitzvah shevis is?
Shevis is the mitzvah that applies to all human beings, Gentile, woman, men, to populate the world. There is a specified mitzvah for a Jewish man to have a boy and a girl that has much more specific requirements. It's only on a Jewish man, not on a Jewish woman. It's not only on a Jewish man, not on a Gentile. But there's still a mitzvah of from Midivrei Sofrim called Shevis that the Hashem wants the world to be populated. And that lower level mitzvah, Rabbi Willig suggests, even that lower level mitzvah is still enough to warrant Bimotzi Zer Levatel to fulfill that. That's a chiddush. Okay, next point. We know the Gemara tells us that after 10 childless years, a husband should divorce his wife because he has to have children to fulfill the mitzvah of Puravu. We know that the Shulchan Aruch tells us in Eben Ezra, we don't enforce this halacha anymore. And Rabbi Willig wants to suggest that maybe it's for the following reason. Maybe we don't follow this. And there are many people, meaning when you have a frum couple that didn't have a baby after 10 years, we don't obligate them to get divorced. And Rabbi Willig suggests, based on a... okay, we're not going to go into the reason for now. There's a Meshech Chachma. We're not going to... Time constraints don't allow us to go into that. Let's talk about Shevis now. The Gemara tells us that... The Pasuk... I'm sorry, the Gemara tells us if a person had children when he's young, he should have children when he's old. If a person... has children, they should have more children later. Why? Because the pasuk says, "Ba'erev al tanach yadach." Even in the evening, the later years of life, don't stop. Now, that sounds like a mitzvah. Okay, sami d'oraisa, it's midrei sofrim, mitzvah b'rechiyev to continue to have children, even though you fulfilled pruvu, to keep on having children. I don't know if that ever stops. Keep on having more and more and more and more and more and more, more children. Sounds like a chiyev, right? So the Ramban in the Milchamos suggest, and this is a very important point, that this mitzvah to continue having children even after you fulfill the base mitzvah pruvu is not a chiyuv. It's only the words of the Ramban. Please get these four words: ke'ein yishuv derech eretz, ke'ein yishuv derech eretz. It sounds like it's not even a chiyuv derabanan. It sounds like it's the right thing to do. It's a good idea, but it can't be described as obligatory. With that in mind, perhaps we could understand a shver Ramban. The Rambam writes that a person has to be boa, a man gets married, he has to be with his wife, b'chol ona. Every time she comes back from the mikveh, they have to try to have a baby. Each time, each mikveh trip, that until he has a boy and a girl, and afterwards she could be mochel if she doesn't want her husband to be with her. Asks the Beis Shmuel on the Shulchan Aruch, what right does she have to be mochel? How could she be mochel? There's a chiyuv of la'erev al tanach edech of continuing to have children. So perhaps we could answer this svara that we said before based on the Ramban. Maybe we could answer that the Ramban is telling us that there's no chiyuv to continue having children. It's the right thing to do. It's proper thing. There's not a chiyuv. And if she wants to be mochelis, then she doesn't want to do that. Ke'en yishuv derech eretz is a good idea. She has the right to do so. That's one answer. Another answer is the Pischei Tshuva says a different answer. It just means that after a person fulfilled pravut, they don't have to be bo'al b'chol ona. Of course, they should still have children, but it doesn't have to be every month to have another baby. But you can't ever say, I'm never having children again, says this opinion. But it just means it could be less frequent. It doesn't have to be b'chol ona v'ona. So you have two answers how the Rambam could say that there would be mechila. Fine. Now, let's move to the next point. Let's now begin the discussion of family planning and a woman's shibud to bear children. The Rabban tells us that a man loses his wife, he has a lot of children, and if he gets married to a young woman with whom he could bear more children, he's worried there could be fights and arguments between step siblings, and she's not going to take care of his kids, and they're going to fight. So in such a case, even though a man should really always try to marry a woman with whom he could have more children, in such a case, to prevent fights, the Rama says, you can marry an isha she eina bas banim, which itself shows that to have the children later in life after you have fulfilled puravu is not chiv gamer, right? If you didn't fulfill puravu, you can't just marry a sterile woman or an older woman, postmenopausal woman. You can't. You have a mitzvah puravu. But if you already fulfilled puravu, you only have the mitzvah of continuing to have children, that is to prevent fighting, you could marry an isha she'ena bas banim. Let me ask you a question. Let's say he's married. He has his wife. His wife didn't die. His wife is right here. And they're standing in front of the rabbi. And his wife says, I don't want any children. And he says, I do want to have children. I have a mitzvah of la'erev al tanach yadecha. So says Rabbi Willig, if when he's not married, we allow him to marry an isha she'ena bas banim to prevent fighting. Certainly when he is married, we should be able to say a kal v'chomer that to prevent fighting with his wife, that we don't have to obligate him to have more children. So based on what we just said, we just explained, based on this kal v'chomer from the Rama, that if a woman doesn't want to have more children, this man would no longer be obligated to fulfill the erev al tanach yedecha if that would enable him to not have this fighting with his wife. Furthermore, the Chasam Sofer says that once person fulfilled puravu, a woman, if she wants to drink a koshel ikarin, meaning make herself no longer able to have children, make herself sterile going forward. So the Chasam Sofer says, if she has hard pregnancies, she's not mechuyevus letzara atma because of her shiba to her husband, to do la erev. Again, if he has the puravu, that's a much bigger chiyuv. But if the leftover he fulfilled puravu, there's only a remaining chiyuv of la'erev al tanach edecha. Well, if she wants to drink a koshel ikarin and prevent herself from becoming pregnant, well, if she says the Chasam himself, if she's sickly, she has hard pregnancy, she doesn't want to become pregnant again, she is permitted to do that, to drink that koshel ikarin. Ramosha has a big kula and says that if she's weaker than average in her pregnancies, then it would be permitted to wait even before puravu. But after puravu, you could wait, meaning after she had a baby, but she's weaker than average, then she'd be able to wait a little bit before the next child. And after puravu, Ramosh says you could even wait 3 years. And if after puravu she's really sickly, then she could say she doesn't want any more kids, like the Chasam Sofer says, because the mitzvah of la'erev, of having more children later, after having already fulfilled puravu, does not require that she has to become sicker than normal. In terms of a special needs child, there's that Ramosha spoke about, the Rabbi Willig had felt otherwise. There is an opinion quoted from Rav Henkin that just like the Gemara tells us that a nursing woman nurses for 2 years, and a nursing woman, that is a natural contraceptive, and a woman who would be nursing full-time would not become pregnant. So based on that, Rav Henkin is quoted as holding that after a person had even their first child, even not a purva, just their first child, they were permitted to avoid having children for another 2 years afterwards, to delay having a second child for 2 years after the first birth. But after 2 years, she would again be mishubedes to her husband. Moshe says there's no such minhag, there's no such heter in Europe to allow such a thing, to allow 2 years. There's no such a thing. Rabbi Willig in general holds that the way families are expected or women are expected to have children is based on what was assumed at the time of their marriage. If one of them moves to the right or to the left after marriage, each party could say that when we got married, it was assumed were we more than Orthodox? Were we Yeshivish? Were we Hasidish at the time we got married? That was the assumptions that came in to the marriage, and that would be what should govern the arguments later on in a marriage. As far as the modes and the methods of using when it is permitted to delay having children, how to do so, which is a separate shaila, let's talk about that shaila now. So an intrauterine device, an IUD, is mutter. The most mutter, of course, where there's no, is the pill. Well, again, when there is a heter to delay children, how to do so, the pill would be the best way of those ways. IUD is also permitted, a Mirena IUD, which prevents, which gives off a hormone to stop some menstruation. That's also mutter, but many poskim say, Rabbi Willig, Rabbi Yosha, that if, even though it stops the period, if it does give it one drop a month, that drop a month might render her needed the rights. That's important to keep in mind. Spermicide is also permitted. Surgery, of course, is serous. That's usher, probably usher deraisa. Using the diaphragm is more complicated. But meikar hadin, there's room to make even by a diaphragm, because even though it's a block, it's not like a condom, which is not permitted. A diaphragm, which seems like condom, because it's preventing the flow of the zera, but it's not really, because the zera is deposited regularly in the where it has to be deposited, and just prevented from flowing upstream into the uterus, as opposed to the condom where it's not deposited in the right place. So those are the various modes. Let's go to the next point. The next point is, what about at the very beginning of marriage? Could a couple say, we don't want to have children at the beginning of our marriage, we want to push it off? So Rabbi Willig is very strong in saying that a couple does not have the right to do that. And he has three proofs. Number one, the Rambam tells us that when a person gets married, lo yisa ketana. Now, can I ask you a question? Why not? The ketana will become a gdola in a year or two. If you marry an 11-year-old, she'll be 12 in a year. If you marry a 10-year-old, she'll be 12 in 2 years. So why can't you be married a ketana? So, because that even though she will later be on, but right now it's also to marry her, because hashtahu mechuyev, when you marry her, you mechuyev to have children. So you can't marry a woman with a chiyev to have children, and she's a ketana. Well, if you take a pill, says Rabbi Willig, even though you're 22 years old, but you take a pill, you're marrying a ketana. So that should be problematic. Secondly, the Shulchan Aruch opens, Evan Ezra, the very first line of Evan Ezra, and I always show the chassanim and kallahs that I'm a Sadat Kedush, I always show them this opening line of Evan Ezra. Chayev li seisha. Why? So you could reach your shlemus? No. So you should be saved from hirurim? No. So you could become a bal chesed? No. Kedei lifros vilirbos. The purpose of marriage is to have children. So to get married and not have children just seems oxymoronic. And thirdly, says Rabbi Willig, the Rambam said explicitly that until a person has fulfilled pruv, chayev livo b'chol ona va'ona. And if you are taking the pill, that's not going to be chayev livo b'chol ona va'ona to have children. Oh, the Rambam says you're allowed to delay marriage. You don't have to get married right away if you're learning. That's true. But once you're married, then you have to have children right away. There's a chiyuv once you're married. If you're not married yet, you don't have the chiyuv yet of pruvu. But once you are married, then the chiyuv pruvu sets in. You can't delay that. Now, as far as if there are genetic complications, we're not going to talk about that. And that's all we're going to discuss on this shiur. Okay, now, gentlemen, would you like me to go over mezuzah? Do you want to stop here? Let me just see where people are. Okay, let's go to the next shiur. We're now going to talk about the two shiurim from Rabbi Simon on Hilchas Mezuzah. And what we have to know about mezuzah is that you only put a mezuzah in a room that's dalet al dalet, dalet amos by dalet amos. And there's a question whether dalet by dalet means 16 square amas, or means a minimum of four on each side, a four on this side, and a four on that side. So here we have a machlokas. The Rambam says even 8 by 2 or 16 by 1 is chayav, as long as you have 16 square amos. And the Rambam says, no, you need a minimum of dafka, 4 on each side. A small, long, a long hallway that's narrow would not be chayav, says the Rush. So the Shach says, okay, so be machmir on a hallway, let's say that's 2 by 8, 16 squared, but not 4 by 4. Put it up without a bracha. But the Taz says, no, you need at least 4 by 4 because that's a livable area. And the Chazon Ish was Mekel, like the Taz, and therefore a narrow hallway that's less than 4 amos wide would never need a mezuzah. Okay, let's talk about walk-in closets or rooms or booths that have usage, but they're less than 4 by 4. So less than 4 by 4 shouldn't be chayv in a mezuzah, right? However, the Chamudei Daniel writes that a 4 by 4 is only the required size for a base dira. But a porch, a closet, a hallway, which its use is not for dira, its use is in this shape or this size, it is a function. If you have a 2 amma by 2 amma security booth, that's exactly what a security booth is supposed to be. It's chazi lemilsei. It's functional in that smaller size. That would be chayev, says the Chamudei Daniel, even if it's less than 4 by 4 amos. That's a big chiddush. Why is that a big chiddush? So like in my house, if you come into my house, my front door, I have a little ante room. That's just like that you walk in, there's a coat closet, and then there's another doorway that you come into the rest of my house, That front room doesn't need a mezuzah. My front door in my house doesn't need a mezuzah. But according to the Chamudei Daniel, I do have to put a mezuzah there because it's serving as an ante room. And therefore would need a mezuzah. But of course, without a bracha. When you have a walk-in closet, same thing. When you have a walk-in closet, it's probably the walk-in area is less than 4 by 4 amos, but since it's a functioning as its walk-in area of the walk-in closet, it would need a mezuzah, according to the Chamudei Daniel. However, you should know that even if you're going to be machmir for this Chamudei Daniel would indicate that when you walk into that small room, you need a mezuzah as a chumra for this Chamudei Daniel on the right side entering that small room, that small anteroom, that small porch, that small closet, that small walk-in closet. However, Bekevager says that when you have a situation of a like a walk-in closet that comes, that's small in dalad al dalad, but opens up to a larger room, let's not look at going from the big bedroom into this walk-in closet that's smaller than dalad al dalad. Let's look at it coming from this small room, which is meaningless, it's a small room, going into this, what Rebecca Vega says, going into the big bedroom. And therefore you should need a mezuzah going from the small closet, this less than dollar by dollar closet, into the big bedroom. And therefore that would mean you'd put it on the right side going into the bedroom, which means going from the bedroom is really on the left side going into the closet. Chamudei Daniel, we said a minute ago, says put it on the right side going into this is a room as is, going into the closet. The Rebecca Vega says, no, you should position it. Same thing. I had this shaila many times. You have a small porch that's very small, but it's going into the on the second floor. A small porch going into the kitchen on the first floor. Going into the room. It's going into a room that's dalad al. Put, says Rebbe Kvega, put it on the right side, going from the small room, the small porch, the small closet, into the bigger room. Which means when you're going from the big room, the main way of walking from the big room into that small area, that small closet or small porch, it's going to be on the left side. So Rabbi Simon doesn't like this, Rabbi Kvega, even though many posts can hold from it. Rabbi Simon doesn't like it because he says that's not walking from the way we always walk in a certain way. We have a way of walking. We have derech beischa, we learn derech biascha, the way you go from one room to another room. If you walk from the kitchen to the porch, you're going out to the porch, or you're walking from a bedroom into a closet. When we have a case from the closet to the bedroom, that's not walking in to the room. That's walking backwards out of a closet. So Rabbi Simon doesn't like this Rabbi Kvego so much and prefers the Chamudei Daniel. Okay, let's now talk about the need for doors. So it's important to know that the Rambam writes that you only put up a mezuzah when there's a door. We, of course, put mezuzahs, even if there's no door, as long as there's a doorway. However, to be machmir for that Shita Sarama, we'll always not make a bracha. We'll always omit a bracha if there's a doorway without a door. So any of you who live in the Heights, you have lots of doorways to the kitchen, to the living room, to the dining room, where there are doorways but no doors. So all of those will get a mezuzah, but no bracha to be machmir for the Rambam. It's important to realize that if you have an apartment building, since there are usually goyim who are shutf in that apartment building, a shutfus of an akum patters you. So if you have a house that's partners with a guy, that house is putter. Let's talk about how high up the side of the mezuzah you position the mezuzah. So if you put it up on the wrong side, on the left side, whatever is considered the correct side, if you put it on the wrong side, you're not yotzei. If you put it up too low, below the bottom third, if you put it up too high, which is in the top tefach of the mashkof, you're not yotzei at all. A lot of people don't know that. If you put it in the wrong position on the door post, if in the top tefach or below the top third, you're not yotzei. So with this in mind, let's talk about, you have a kid's room. You want to put the mezuzah low down so the little kid could kiss the mezuzah. It's so cute, right? Wrong. You're not yotzei because it's below the shlish ha'elyu. Where in the shlish ha'elyu should it be? So we said it cannot be in the top tefach. Ideally, it should be the bottom of that shlish ha'elyu. So what you have to do, you take a measurement. Let's say the height of your doorway is 60 inches. So at the 40th inch, above the 40th inch, which is two-thirds from the bottom, you put it at the bottom, you'll put at inch 41, 42, 43 at that height. That's where you'll put your mezuzah. What happens if you have a very tall door? So if we follow Shlisha Elyon, that's going to be all the way. It's going to be 10, 20 feet high. But there's Yishalmi that says you should put it at the shoulder height. Shoulder height is much lower than the top Shlisha Elyon. So is that against our Bavli? So Rabbi Vadi suggests that it's not against the Bavli. What it really means is that when the Bavli says Shlisha Elyon, the reason why it says Shlisha Elyon is because that's what just happens to be where the shoulder is. So if you have a very tall door, Shlisha Elyon happens to be mathematically very high, but really you should still put it at the height of your shoulder. That's really what the Yishalmi meant when you put it at shoulder height, because Shlisha Elyon that you and I call is just means at the shoulder height. Fine. When we have the what Rabbi Simon calls the Washington Heights kitchens, doorways where you have a cabinet on the bottom invading the space of the doorway, and then you have an opening, so should you put the mezuzah on the walls, the thin area of the opening where you walk through on the side of the cabinet, like 2 feet high? Or should you put it at shoulder height in the much wider opening area of the cabinets? I hope you remember that diagram. So the Nesiva says that if the cabinets are 10 tefachim high, put it on the top third of the cabinets. That's going to be around your knees, because you're not even walking through that halal, that area of the above the cabinet, above the shelf of the cabinet. But others say no, you should do Shlisha Elyon on your shoulder height, and therefore Rabbi Simon would say you should put it at shoulder height, even in that Washington Heights cabinet blocked entranceway scenario. Fine.
Sorry to jump in, can you just describe a little more of the scenario?
Yes. It's better if you have a picture, but it's going to be hard for the people listening to the audio to see what the picture looks like. I will draw a picture. Okay. There's a cabinet that's scribbled on. There's a cabinet that's scribbled on, and this is where you walk in. You walk in here. Here's a cabinet on your right and on your left. And again, I don't know if this is your right or your left, but you could either put the mezuzah at the top of the cabinet, which is around your waist or your between your knees, your thighs, or you could put it up at shoulder height. So that would be a machlokas. Rabbi Simon says you should go with that one, the one at shoulder height. So those who saw it understand. Those who are listening don't understand what I just said, but I'm sorry. Okay, let's talk about the next point, which is leaving mezuzahs when you're moving out. I get this shaila every few months. Sometimes they get the shaila too late, and they lost. If you think of a house that has 25 doorways, each mezuzah is $100. That means $2,500. This shaila is a $2,500 to $3,000 shaila. If you're in an apartment, it's only a $1,500 shaila because you only have 10 or 15 mezuzahs. Depends on how big your apartment is. So the halacha is that if you know that a Jewish person is moving in after you, you have to leave the mezuzahs. If they're going to be painting and they're going to have to take the mezuzahs down, then you could take down the mezuzahs. If you don't know who's going to be moving in, it might be a Gentile moving in, then you can take down the mezuzahs. If you know who's moving in, a Jew who's moving in after you, you must leave the mezuzahs. However, you could leave inexpensive mezuzahs and take your really fancy, mahadra mezuzahs with you, as long as you left some other mezuzahs. Or additionally, other Amas says you could charge him for the mezuzahs that you left if he doesn't want to pay. That's a discussion if you could take them with you because he doesn't want to pay. we might hold that you have to leave them there anyway, but you're allowed to ask him for the money. Okay. That's as far as leaving mezuzahs. Let's talk about the different rooms or types of rooms that do need a mezuzah. So a storage place, a beis ha'otzer, a garage is chayev. Closets are chayev. If it's a storage place, it's part of your dira that we're describing. Closets, storage rooms, those are chayev. However, if it's not part of your dira, it's a storage facility, a U-Haul facility that you rent, out on the highway, that's not part of your dira, that's not chayev. But a garage, whether it's an attached garage or a disattached garage, you will put a mezuzah on. And I think David Feinstein says that you on a disattached garage, you wouldn't make a bracha. I'm not really sure why. I don't get that why. But you wouldn't make a bracha on a disattached garage. Not sure why, but that's what Rav David Zatzal, I used to be Shlita, Rav David who's just nifted a few months ago, said. As far as a shul is pater from mezuzah unless someone like the Shamis, for example, lives there. Beis Medrash is a machlokas because maybe a Beis Medrash is more like a dira because people learn there all day. So we hold Meikar Hadin. The Shulchan Aruch says nachal lahachmir to put a mezuzah on a Beis Medrash, but without a bracha because it might not need. If you have a building, an office, a store, the Gemara says, and the Shulchan Aruch passes a chanus is pater. The Taz says, why is it pater? Because it's a dira sarai, you're not there at night. It could be that that's talking about a makeshift store, like one of those peddler stores that you open during the market and then you close it for the rest of the time, but it could be a permanent building. You would have to. So the minhag is you probably try to put up a mezuzah on your office or on your store without a bracha, though. But if there's a specific situation that you have a hesitation because it might cause problems because of your work situation, whatever that might be, then you don't have to put one up at all. Okay. When you rent an apartment, so the Gemara says that a schiris is pater kol lamed yom. So maybe if the schiris is pater kol lamed yom, you should first put it up on day lamed aleph when you're mechuyev, because you pater for the first 30 days. So I'm going to present to you two or three shitas about what to do when you have rentals. So in the Nesivis, his Derech HaChaim, he says, when we say that, you're pater the first 30 days, that's only if you plan to stay less than 30 days. But if mitchila, you know that you're planning to stay for a whole long time, then you should put the mezuzah up immediately. Rav Shach says, and Rav Shach likes to say this, that when you sign a lease, that's different than what the Gemara is talking about. When the Gemara says you're renting it, they can throw you out any time. But when you sign a lease, they can't throw you out for 12 months. So that's like, even though normally skills low kanya, here it is kanya, because they can't throw you out for 12 months. And therefore, this whole 30-day leniency should not apply. Rav Moshe has a big chiddush. Rav Moshe says that you should put it up right away, but don't make a bracha until day 31. On day 31, then you should touch it and make a bracha. That's an incredible chiddush. You're not doing a maisa of kfiyas mezuzah. How are you saying the kvah mezuzah on day 31? We're not being kvah mezuzah. So that's a discussion among the poskim, how to do it. So Rabbi Simon suggests that right when you move into an apartment, put a mezuzah right away, and especially if you have a lease, and wake a bracha right when you have it. But if you don't have a mezuzah, then you can make it on Chutz La'aretz and put it on the 31st day since you moved in if you don't have another choice. Fine. Let's talk about another point. There's an isser of asur l'shamish mitasa with a person's wife ifnei kisvei hakodesh. So you don't have svarim in a bedroom. The problem is every bedroom has a mezuzah, and that's a sefer. So how do you have a mezuzah on a bedroom when the husband is with the wife? So the Aruch HaShulchan says, well, the Torah knows that you're with your wife, and the Torah knows that you have to put a mezuzah. So the Torah says, you're allowed, this halacha doesn't apply to a bedroom, and therefore you're allowed to put a mezuzah on the bedroom. That's Aruch HaShulchan's tremendous kula. There are a few other shitas. The Shulchan Aruch HaRav says, if it's attached to the wall, it's considered a shus b'fnei atzmo, so it's okay. The Chai Adam says, you should wrap it with two wrappings. Well, the case is one wrapping, and you should have in mind that the wrapping, like the plastic or the saran wrap, inside is not miyuchel, because whenever you have a double wrapping heter, one of them can't be miyuchel l'kach. So you have to have in mind that one of those two things, either the plastic wrapping around the mezuzah cloth or the case, is not miyuchel l'kach. That you should have in mind. Then you'll have two hangings. The stipler says you should put a nail above the mezuzah and hang a towel or a t-shirt over the mezuzah before tashmish. I've never seen that. And there's the Yesh Omer in the Ramah that says that it's a room where tashmish occurs. It's just pasuk doesn't require mezuzah. Just pasuk that doesn't need a mezuzah at all. Bedrooms don't need a mezuzah. Okay. Ideally, if you have a doorway that swings however it swings, put the mezuzah outside the door. So when the door is closed, the mezuzah is positioned outside the doorway in the hallway, and therefore the door could be closed and the mezuzah outside. Okay, now let's talk about archways. Archways, we assume, are chayev, but usually there's no door, so you're not going to make a bracha. Where is the height of the mezuzah? How do you measure the height? So this is a machlokas rishonim, and some say that you should put it a tefach below the curvatures, beginning. That's a discussion how to calculate the height. That's something to be important, keep in mind. When you put up the mezuzah and there's a width of the doorway, the doorpost is, let's say, 6 inches wide, you should always put the mezuzah closer to the outside so there's more shmira. It maximizes the shmira. Don't put it on the middle. You want to maximize the shmira. Okay, that's all we'll do for now.